May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jason Middleton, registration number 25314, representing Edward DeGray in this matter. I will do my best to track my own time and reserve some for rebuttal, Your Honor. I plan to focus my arguments today on issue two in this case, which is the issue of self-defense in relation to the charge of aggravated robbery. Under the unique circumstances of this case, Mr. DeGray was entitled to have the jury instructed regarding the affirmative defense of self-defense in relation to the aggravated robbery. Mr. DeGray was entitled to the self-defense instruction because aggravated robbery is a general intent crime, and the evidence here presented a question of fact for the jury regarding application of self-defense to the alleged robbery. Mr. DeGray testified that all his actions were in self-defense, and significantly, the jury acquitted him of every offense to which self-defense was an affirmative defense under the instructions. To the extent a division of this court's opinion in 1976, the opinion of People v. Beebe held that self-defense is not available as an affirmative defense to aggravated robbery, that is incompatible with current self-defense law and should not be followed by this court. Its holding is in conflict with Colorado Supreme Court's decision in Pickering and this court's recent decisions in Taylor and Mullins, as well as the statutory language itself and cases interpreted. The question is, what would make robbery different from other general intent crimes where this court and the Supreme Court have found self-defense to be applicable? And the answer is nothing. The robbery statutes do not limit the applicability of the affirmative defense. The self-defense statute does not limit the applicability of the affirmative defense in relation to robbery.
What was the defendant
exercising self-defense with respect to the taking?
What occurred in this case, and there are very different stories from the defendant testified and the alleged victim both testified, and have dramatically different, well, initially it's fairly similar, but then they diverge. And Mr. DeGray's testimony was that he did not have the money for the fare, that he provided the cab driver his ID to essentially hold as collateral, that he was locked in the cab. He eventually was let out of the cab, and he told the cab driver, "Thank you, I'm going to go get the money now to pay for the fare." And at that time, the cab driver grabbed him and prevented him from going to get the money, and that's when the physical altercation ensued from there.
So wasn't he defending himself from the physical aspect rather than from the taking? I mean, there was it wasn't necessary for him to use a deadly weapon because of the cab fare, was it?
No, I think the issue is that the taking here is so intertwined with the use of physical force that when he left, he was leaving to go get the money, and he, according to his testimony, was physically assaulted, and at that point reacted in self-defense. Now, the knife came out later on when he felt he was being hit with something that was potentially a knife or a screwdriver. He couldn't identify what it was, and it was never actually identified. But the altercation, the physical altercation where he began acting in self-defense occurred as he was going to get the money, and as a result, he never got the money, which resulted in the taking, because the fare was never paid. So he had the intent, he testified he had the intent all along to pay the fare. He testified that he had $10 in his wallet, but not the additional $4.35, and that he was going to get it. The cab driver actually testified that he had Mr. DeGray's ID with the idea that Mr. DeGray would go get the money. And then, like I said, their stories diverge as to what happened from that point on. So it's our position that the taking here occurred only because of the physical force employed against Mr. DeGray and his reaction in self-defense, which resulted in the fare ultimately not being paid. Does that answer your question?
So, Mr. Middleton, what I want you to address a little bit is what role are you advocating? You want us to diverge from Beebe or Beebe, but do you want us to apply a Drago? If the evidence supports self-defense for any general intent crime, then the jury should be so instructed, or where are the boundaries?
It's my position, and I would refer to Pickering, where it says, with respect to crimes requiring intent, knowledge, or willfulness, self-defense is an affirmative defense. And if a defendant charged with such a crime raises credible evidence that he acted in self-defense, then the jury should be instructed on it as an affirmative defense. So, yes, essentially when there's a general intent offense or specific intent, if under the facts presented to the court, there's a legitimate claim of self-defense in relation to the offense, then the jury should be instructed upon that as an affirmative defense.
Let me try again. Assume that we don't agree with you about taking, that this was in, that his, he was entitled to self-defense because of the taking. Would you still argue that he was entitled to, we call it self-defense, but entitled to the statutory defense based on the fact that he was attacked by, under his version of facts, by the taxpayer in connection with the taking, but not as a result of the taking?
Well, and again, I think there's so many, I think I understand what you're saying. He's already intertwined. Self-defense has been referred to as a defense in justification. So when it's an affirmative defense, it's not necessarily negating one of the or the other of the elements. The defendant is essentially admitting the conduct and saying, I was justified in doing it under these circumstances. This court's opinion, Judge Ramon's opinion and Taylor discussed that to some extent. And it would be my position that when they are intertwined, understand there may be some temporal distinction there. And there's an argument that the taking or the force, whichever, resulted from the self-defense, then the defendant should be allowed to present that to the jury, and it's for the jury to determine.
So there's two elements, I mean, there are more than two, but basically right. There's the taking element, but then there's also the his use of a deadly weapon.
Correct.
And that could be simply in response to the attack or the his perceived perception that he was about to pull a knife or a gun.
Correct.
Counsel, I understand your position on this issue that you've been talking about, the self-defense instruction, but I have a question for you about Batson. So I do want to switch gears, even though you didn't come here to talk about that necessarily.
I will do my best.
We have a comparative juror analysis going on here.
Yes.
In front of this court. But it wasn't done at the trial court level.
Correct.
Does that not restrict us in some way when the defendant's counsel didn't stand up and say, well, if you compare this prospective juror to this prospective juror, you'll see they're exactly the same or they're different or whatever. Why should we be able to go on a cold record at this point when that wasn't argued below?
Well, I would say for the reasons that I tried to set forth in my reply brief, in Snyder and I can't remember if it was both Miller L cases or one of the Miller L cases, this U.S. Supreme Court did a comparative analysis on those direct appeals when it had not been performed below. It was discussed as part of the circumstances that are analyzed in considering any Batson claim. There are some cases from other jurisdictions that I've discussed where they refer to this as not really being a new issue. It's really on appeal, the appellant marshaling the circumstantial evidence from the record that supports the idea that this was a pretextual strike. In I don't know, this court's Phillips case, the court declined to do a comparative analysis, citing language from Snyder. But interestingly, the language it cited from Snyder was where Snyder was saying, well, it's better essentially for the lower court to do it, but we're going to go ahead and do it anyway. So the Snyder court did it. It was not language suggesting that a court should not do it on appeal. It was just noting some of the difficulties associated with that. So it would be my position in the argument I made in the reply that really what this is, I mean, the record is there. The jurors' answers are there. The evidence for this court or anyone to assess the comparative analysis necessary is already there. It's just an argument being set forth on appeal in support of the claim that these were pretextual strikes.
Thank you.
it's your position that if the if there are, let's say there are three clearly race-neutral reasons given, and one that you could call lame or pretextual, that's enough, and it requires that the Batson challenge be upheld.
Yes, if one of the reasons is pretextual, then that requires the Batson challenge to be upheld.
Even if it's not on its face racially discriminatory.
Correct, because that's the issue with many pretextual claims, is that on their face, they're not racially discriminatory, but when you do the comparative juror analysis, then you can determine that it was pretextual and therefore was racially discriminatory.
Does the judge have to sort of reach the next step and say it's pretextual because of purposeful discrimination? Having sat there and observed the whole thing unfold in front of him or her?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, what you're saying, as I understand it, is once you reach pretext, you've reached a discrimination. And what I'm asking is there not another step, like a pretext for discrimination? Does the judge have to say, this is a pretext for discrimination, is what I find?
That's a good question. I'm not sure off the top of my head. My understanding is that the evidence of pretext is itself essentially evidence of a discriminatory purpose.
It certainly could be, but I could also see where it might not necessarily be. It might have been pretext for something else.
Correct. And I'm not aware, you know, in Snyder they talked about the pretextual purpose, and I don't believe they did an additional step in there. The same with Miller L. So I understand what you're saying. I think essentially what the case law holds, though, is that the pretext equals discriminatory purpose, or perhaps given the nature of the interests involved, they're willing to just say that pretext seems to indicate discriminatory purpose, and therefore they will, you know.
Okay. And you have 3 minutes left.
If the court doesn't have additional questions, I'll save the remainder of my time for a month.
Great.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Kevin McReynolds, Colorado Bar number 40978, on behalf of the people. I also would like to focus on the self-defense issue, though I'm happy to talk about Batson as well. The primary issue here is that robbery is different. It was not error for the trial court to follow this court's well-established case law and the national consensus that robbery is different, and as a general matter, self-defense cannot justify a robbery. Now, the reason for that is what Judge Miller touched upon, is that robbery involves two distinct but related criminal acts, both a taking and use of force. And by its terms, self-defense under 18.1704 justifies a person's use of physical force in order to protect and defend themselves against imminent harm. It does not justify any other kind of criminal conduct. And understanding that distinction and sort of how it's been interpreted nationally, and it was touched upon in Beebe, sort of helps understand the one narrow exception that has been recognized in case law, where the taking itself is justified by the need to defend yourself. And those are the cases where an individual is literally taking a weapon from an assailant. That temporarily taking that weapon from an assailant, both the taking and the use of force, are justified by self-defense because that action is, in fact, justified by his need to defend himself.
Mr. McReynolds?
Yes, go ahead, Judge.
Would you agree that robbery and aggravated robbery are general intent crimes?
I would agree that they are general intent crimes.
How then do you reconcile Beebe with Pickering?
You reconcile in terms of what Beebe says is that this defense can apply as a justification for a general intent crime that involves the use of force, because by its own, Pickering couldn't expand what self-defense is. Self-defense is a justification for the use of physical force. It's not like other defenses we have, duress, choice of evils, which can, duress, for example, can justify any criminal action short of class 1 felony. so long as you meet both the statutory and the common law elements for duress. That's just not the case with if you look at the statutes written very differently. It's written in terms of the use of physical force to defend yourself or a third person against either the use or the imminent use of a physical force against yourself. And that, I think, is what was touched upon in Beebe itself and is discussed. I think one of the better discussions of it is in the Graves case from Illinois that was cited in the People's Answer Brief, which was addressing, in Graves, for example, specifically, whether or not in a robbery case an individual should have gotten a self-defense affirmative defense instruction. They found that they did not, because the taking itself in that case, it was the taking of property, but the taking of services here, was outside, it was different from the limited, narrow exception. It was different from the case where the taking and the use of force were singularly coinciding as being a single act and both justified by that fear. And distinguished on that ground said, no, the general rule applies. The narrow exception doesn't apply because the taking is a different criminal act. You don't get an affirmative defense of self-defense for something more than your use of force for this taking, where the taking itself is not justified by that fear of imminent harm.
The problem I have with that is, in this situation, if you take the defendant's version of the story, he was just saying, I just wanted to go and go get the money out of the house. And the taxi driver attacked me, so I resisted that attack by using force. So the charge here is not just robbery, the charge here is aggravated robbery. And I think what you're saying is it has to be self-defense, has to apply to every single element of the crime. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that in order for self-defense to justify a criminal action, which is what it would have to be an improper affirmative defense, it would have to justify the all the criminal acts.
But wouldn't it be a defense to the aggravation part of the robbery contention in this case? The use of a deadly weapon?
And I think theoretically it could be. These are, you know, under the model instructions are charged as a single offense. The robbery cannot be justified, but could the aggravation be justified? I could say theoretically possible. The Rogers case in out of Massachusetts that the people cited sort of discussed why you can't do that, because it involves essentially segmenting the force elements from different parts of an individual crime. Our statute's a little bit different. I think had that been presented as a separate sort of sentence enhancement with a separate requested instruction on self-defense there, I think that would be a much closer question. Here, because we have a singular proposed instruction from the defense that would have sought to justify the entire crime, the robbery all the way through, including the aggravation. It is a different thing here because it cannot justify the taking.
Well, the jury here found that there was no theft. So if you focus just on the taking part, not on the robbery or the aggravated part, it seems a little odd to require that.
I would say that a key distinction here is that robbery and theft are different offenses with different intent to permanently deprive is not an element of robbery. And I'm going to pay you back is not a defense to robbery, while it is a defense to theft. So I don't think the jury's verdict is inconsistent in that way at all.
Yeah, and I wasn't necessarily suggesting it was, but the taking does not involve any kind of force at all. There's nothing about a taking that requires force.
It does not require
that element. Force comes up because in order to get robbery, or in this case aggravated robbery, the defendant must have used force, or in this case deadly.
Or also threats or intimidation,
yes,
which is another means of committing it. The jury was instructed on that. And to go back to your point, I think this is a legal distinction. Whether or not the taking in fact is as in the narrow exceptions for the taking of a weapon, whether the taking and the use of force were both justified by the defendant's fear and need to use force, The facts of this case, even going, as you suggested, to defendant's latest version of events, what he testified to at trial, it still would not line up. Because first, as we argued in the answer brief and as the prosecution presented the case, is that there was a temporal distinction here that the services, he'd already received them, he took them without paying by climbing in the back, putting himself directly behind the cabbie, which prompted him to leave the car, and they both got out of the car. At that point, I think the taking, the simple robbery, is arguably completed at that point, even under defendant's version of events, because the defendant has, he's intimidated, and he has received services, and he has not paid for those services. But if you were to take even a broader sort of course of the transaction, most expansive possible view, it still doesn't line up. Because what you have there is, you have the fight that happens outside the cab, you have the cabbie flee the scene, and then defendant leaves. An analogy I thought of preparing for this would be, if you're at a restaurant, you don't have the money to pay, you attempt to leave the restaurant, you have a fight with the waiter, you knock the waiter unconscious, and then you leave, your taking of the services without paying for them is not justified by your fear of the waiter, because he wasn't there to endorse, to cause you any more fear. He was no longer, in this case, the cabbie was no longer there. He'd run away. The defendant fled the scene. I think it would have been a much more plausible defense. From a legal standpoint, I don't think it makes sense factually, would have been to suggest a choice of evils defense, that he had to leave the scene because he didn't know if the cabbie would come back or something along those lines. Legally, that could, unlike self-defense, justify criminal conduct of taking as opposed to only use of physical force. But factually, he wouldn't have been able to meet the common law requirements for that, because in those cases, duress, choice of evils, what we have is you have to then report, as soon as you're out of the immediate danger, you then have to report to authorities what's going on. It's here, he fled the scene, heard the cops were looking for him, and disappeared for several months.
Mr. McReynolds?
Yes.
As you just described your hypotheticals, aren't you putting spins on various interpretations of the evidence that should be before the jury if the legislator intended to allow the self-defense affirmative defense?
I think that there could be a case in which, like in the taking of a weapon case, and I think there could be a hypothetical where there is no longer a legal distinction, but it becomes a factual question. I don't think this is that case, because I don't think there is any reasonable viewing of the facts that does show that the same singular scenario that you have in the taking of a physical weapon, which is both your use of force and your need to take are both justified by your actual fear of imminent force. That's just not the case here. It's either the taking was fully completed before they had to fight outside the cab, or he completed the taking after he left the scene.
Do you have any authority that an omission to pay is a taking under the statute? I know it wasn't raised below.
Yes, and I did not look into that issue, Your Honor. If you'd like me to brief that, I'd be happy to. I did not run across it while researching this issue.
Okay.
So let's just skip ahead and assume that there needs to be a self-defense instruction. Is it necessary to also instruct on the taxi driver's right to protect his property interest and the monies that weren't paid?
Yeah, it would raise another factual issue, which is self-defense only applies to the use of force against unlawful physical force. The taxi driver, even if believing the defendant that he held him and wouldn't let him leave the scene, the taxi driver was entitled to do that under 18-17-077. It was a citizen's arrest. You can't leave the scene here. I've called the cops. They're coming because you took the cab fare here. And that would be That would be another factual issue. I think that's another reason why, you know, if you did find an error here, it is a harmless error for that reason, and also for the reason that the jury rejected self-defense. I disagree with my colleague here. The jury's verdicts, yes, they did acquit on the higher assault charges, but they did find him guilty of the assault too reckless, but then checked the box, no serious bodily injury. But what they really found, the reason they didn't convict him of the attempt murder, the first degree assault, was not because they believed his self-defense story. It was because they did not find a serious bodily injury or intent to cause a serious bodily injury, and that's completely consistent with the way the verdicts came out.
I'm going to switch gears on you, too.
Okay.
And go back to Batson.
Sure.
Do you agree with your counterpart that one example of a pretextual explanation constitutes a discrimination?
Absolutely not.
And do you have authority for that?
I didn't think of anything specifically to that. With regard to what we have here, I think that there's no real issue with that in this case because we had more than what we had in Snyder. In Snyder, at trial, there was a dispute. Both the trial counsel disputed both the demeanor explanation and the objectively verifiable explanation. Disputed both of those were true about this juror, and then the Snyder court did find extraordinary circumstances that justified doing a comparative juror analysis. Finding one of those reasons had been absolutely refuted by the record, and the other one couldn't be relied upon because it was a demeanor explanation. There was no specific ruling on it. This is very different. What we have here are unrebutted comments that are race-neutral reasons for this juror strike. The defendant not only he actually supported the prosecution's reading. Yes, he does appear frail. Yes, his demeanor was very assertive of his right to self-defense. Acknowledged them, recognized they existed, did not dispute them. There's no basis to do a comparative analysis on that, and there are actually cases in other jurisdictions that have found Snyder and his progeny do not apply where you have unrebutted reasons on the record that can support it. And I think Snyder also is sort of instructive on your earlier question, Judge Roman, which was they found they had to reverse because because they couldn't rely on the demeanor-based explanation as being supported by the record, and the other reason by comparative juror analysis was absolutely refuted by the record, and that's why there was reversal. Had there been a specific finding that I find the demeanor reason sufficient, that would have been enough in Snyder, even though those were disputed below. I seem out of time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Briefly, in 2003, the legislature enacted Subsection 4 of the self-defense statute, where it basically set forth when self-defense is not available as an affirmative defense, and they mentioned reckless, extreme indifference, and criminally negligent. The last line of that says, this section shall not apply to strict liability crimes. Well, this section doesn't apply to strict liability crimes. The legislature did not say, this section shall not apply to strict liability crimes or robbery. They could have said that. They could have excluded robbery. They did nothing to exclude robbery. As far as any national consensus about robbery, I would beg to differ. Most of the cases cited by the state do not find that robbery is, or self-defense is not a defense to robbery, or they do so on state-specific grounds. For instance, the Graves case from Illinois. Illinois has a statute that says self-defense is not applicable to forcible felonies. The Rogers case that was mentioned, he actually got self-defense. The Washington case they cite, they say robbery does not have a specific intent, and under their construction, self-defense was not available because it would not negate a specific intent. The one case out there that seems to really say the same thing as Beebe or Beebe is the 1963 case out of California, where the court just says Self-defense is not, of course, a recognized defense to a charge of robbery. That's all they say. There's no analysis, no discussion, nothing to indicate why they reached that conclusion. So far from the national consensus, I don't think there is such a thing. Even if there were, very specifically under Colorado law, the expansive interpretation we've given to self-defense under Pickering, under Taylor, under Mullins, where the Supreme Court and this court have found that self-defense is a defense to a general intent crime, I think the law is clear that it should apply to robbery, and there is no basis for some specific robbery exception where, unlike any other offense except for maybe strict liability, you don't get it as an affirmative defense, and you're also not told that you can even consider it in relation to that offense. All offenses should fall under either one or four, the one exception being felony murder, because that has its own statutory affirmative defense in the statute. So for those reasons, I would ask this court to reverse Mr. Kuwait's conviction.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your fine arguments. This case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. We'll set up